It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a tour of the hidden history behind some of Milwaukee's historic buildings.
First, representatives from the Great Lakes Compact Council are standing by Waukesha's water diversion plan. The unanimous agreement followed a request from a group of cities from the United States and Canada, asking the representatives to reconsider their decision.
Waukesha began the effort to draw drinking water from Lake Michigan over a decade ago. It finally got long-sought approval in June of last year.
Peter Annan joins us now to tell us more. He's co-director of the Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation and director of environmental communication at Northland College. Peter, welcome back.
Thank you.
Peter, what issue does the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative have with Waukesha's proposal to divert water from Lake Michigan?
They have several points that they're unhappy with in that decision. The first one is they believe that the city of Waukesha has other water supply alternatives that weren't thoroughly investigated during the application process. They have concerns about the quality of the water that will be returned to Lake Michigan in the Root River and downtown Racine. And they have issues with, more minor issues with Waukesha's service area. Then they have some procedural issues, too, and that they felt that there should have been more public hearings before the final decision was made by the Great Lakes governors.
And why did the Great Lakes governors decide to reject the request to take a fresh look at this?
Yeah, so the procedure is if there's someone who's unhappy with the Council of Great Lakes Governors' decision, they can request a hearing, and in that hearing, the purpose of that request is to ask the governors or their, in this case, their representatives to reconsider their decision. They had a hearing in person where you had attorney for the Mayor's Association and attorneys for Waukesha presenting to the representatives of the eight Great Lakes states, laying out sort of before and or sort of for and against their decision. There was a lot of robust questioning by the representatives of the eight Great Lakes governors, and after deliberating about it for 4 weeks, they came back and yesterday decided that, you know, after hearing the various sides of the case, that they don't feel like there was any reason to reopen or reconsider the decision.
You mentioned a lot of attorneys in that deliberative process there, and now that the governors have said, no, we're not going to reconsider this, is it possible that there could be legal action taken?
Yeah, that's going to be the real interesting thing to follow here in coming weeks. The Mayor's Association request for a hearing over Waukesha read just like a legal case, and the hearing that the Compact Council held last month was very much sort of felt like an appeals court kind of setting, and with set times for each side to make their case, with a little bit of time set aside for rebuttal, et cetera. So it's definitely feeling legal. I think the only question now is whether or not the mayors are upset enough where they're going to take that next potentially expensive step and file a lawsuit challenging the Waukesha decision, or if they're just going to let it go, and we just don't know yet. We haven't heard.
And can you tell us which cities are involved in the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative that are challenging this Waukesha proposal?
Yes, yeah, so it's a binational organization made up, I believe, of more than 100 mayors on, again, both sides of the U.S.-Canada border in the Great Lakes region, literally stretching all the way from Minnesota to Quebec, and so it's a very influential and very important organization, and the incoming executive director of the organization is Mayor Dickert from Racine, which is one of the communities most upset about the Waukesha water diversion, so I think we'll, one way or the other, we'll be continuing to hear from the mayors about this issue.
Well, looking back a little at the history here, now technically, as I understand it, cities located in the Great Lakes Basin are allowed to divert that water. Waukesha is apparently outside of that basin. So how did they initially get approval from the compact?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, this is where we get into some of the complicated nitty-gritty of the Great Lakes Compact, this legal water fence designed to keep Great Lakes water inside the Great Lakes Basin. And within that law, which is a ban on diversions with limited exceptions, there are these two unique limited exceptions for communities that either sit right on the edge of the Great Lakes Basin or communities that are in a county that straddles the Great Lakes Basin. And Waukesha falls under that latter exception clause. And they had a right under the compact to apply for a Great Lakes water diversion, but they needed the approval of all 8 Great Lakes governors. So that's a pretty high bar. Took them $5 million in 5 years or more, depending on what you use as the start date, for their application to be considered. And in the end, it was victorious, at least unless it's successfully challenged in court. But up to now, it's been victorious. So they happen to fall under that really unique exceptions clause. And for communities that are near the basin line, the edge of the watershed line, and they were the first such test case of that exception. And again, depending on whether or not it's litigated, we'll see whether it continues to be tested by the mayors or others could also step forward to file a legal challenge.
We're talking with Peter Annan right now, co-director of the Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation and director of environmental communication at Northland College. And we're talking about what's happening after representatives from Great Lakes states upheld earlier approval of Waukesha's plans to divert water from Lake Michigan to Waukesha. And you said Waukesha is the first of these cities. Are there other cities that are maybe sitting and watching what happens who could be next in line to request water from Lake Michigan?
Yeah, there are definitely other cities that are paying close attention to this. And these, again, are just cities that are on or near the Great Lakes Basin line who fall under these exception clauses. To be absolutely clear, if you're not a city on or near the basin line, you cannot even ask for a Great Lakes water diversion. And all those cities would be required to return the water back to the Great Lakes so that there be no net loss. Which is what Waukesha has agreed to do in its application. But the Alliance for the Great Lakes, an environmental organization in Chicago, did a report a few years ago sort of predicting how many other similar Waukesha-type communities might be out there and might be interested. And they highlighted about 8 or 9 communities stretching from suburban Milwaukee down to Fort Wayne, Indiana, that they predicted could be future applicants for water under these exceptions clauses. We have not heard anything specifically from those communities themselves yet, but they, according to the Alliance for the Great Lakes, so we have, you know, less than a dozen or so, all of whom would be required to return the water and would need to be approved under the rigorous outlines of the Great Lakes Compact.
You mentioned returning the water. What other stipulations are there for communities like Waukesha who want to divert the water?
Yeah, so they have to prove that they have no reasonable water supply alternative, which is, you know, so you can't just go to Great Lakes water because you want it. You have to actually approve to the Great Lakes governors that you don't have any reasonable water supply alternative. You have to have a strict water conservation program, so you wouldn't be allowed to get Great Lakes water if you were just going to waste it through unsustainable water practices. You have to also prove in your application that the water diversion creates no negative environmental impacts. So there's a long list of sort of fine print there that is required, and the governors have been going over that very seriously and very carefully. After all, they wrote the rules, and so now they're just enforcing them.
And how much water is Waukesha set to be drawing up from the Great Lakes if this moves forward?
Yeah, and again, as of now, it has been officially approved and unsuccessfully challenged. They originally asked for 10.1 million gallons of water per day, but the governors decided that that was too much, and they scaled that back to a maximum of 8.6 million gallons per day over, you know, coming decades. They're currently just a little bit under an average of, I think, around 7 million gallons per day. So it sounds like a lot of water to an average person, but In the grand scheme of the 6 quadrillion gallons in the Great Lakes, it's not a large amount. And again, especially since that water is required to be returned to the Great Lakes based under the compact. Nevertheless, the Waukesha water diversion has been highly controversial. And throughout the public hearing process, there were a lot of people who came out in opposition. And that just the idea of diverting water is sort of this visceral reaction to people in the Great Lakes region. They're very, very protective of these globally significant water bodies.
And Peter, just briefly as we wrap up, how big a challenge is this going to be to the cohesion and the vision of the Great Lakes Compact, this city's initiative request to reconsider this and their unhappiness with it?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have the first test case of a major piece of environmental legislation, and it'll be interesting to see if the mayor stepped forward and actually filed a lawsuit. And one of the concerns is that the compact itself could be refined or changed through the legal process. But we're a long way from that right now because we don't even have a suit on the ground yet. But it's definitely going to be worth watching in coming weeks and months.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Peter Annan, co-director of the Burke Center for Freshwater Innovation and director of environmental communication at Northland College. He joined us after representatives from Great Lakes states upheld plans for Waukesha to source water from Lake Michigan.
Right now, have you ever driven past an older building or mansion and thought, I'd sure love to see the inside of that place? Well, our next guest does just that.
Bobby Tanzillo joins us now. He's a writer and senior editor for On Milwaukee, where he writes a regular feature called Urban Spelunking, where he explores and documents old, often historic buildings in the Milwaukee area. Bobby, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, can you give us an idea of what you're looking for when you set out to find a place with history that you can really dive into its past?
Yeah, well, I'm lucky that On Milwaukee basically gives me leeway to sort of follow my muse. So basically, I follow my curiosity and, you know, things that look interesting to me and things that, you know, I started off doing places that were sort of obvious, like City Hall and things like that. But I've really come to kind of appreciate the sort of everyday history in Milwaukee and the sort of more personal history. And I'm a big fan of, like, public and civic buildings. I'm a big fan of schoolhouses, churches, firehouses, you know, buildings that really were kind of important in their neighborhoods and important to people on a daily basis.
Do you ever get surprised by a building? You think, this is an old building, but there's not going to be a lot here. You start digging, and you're surprised at what you find.
Yeah, in a way, I'm surprised all the time, and in a way, now I'm no longer ever surprised, ever surprised, because, you know, I've done so many places that I thought, how am I ever going to get a story out of this? You know, it doesn't seem like there's much going on. You know, you go in the building and you look around and everything's been torn out. But then you start to do a little research and you find that there is just, as I say, there's history in every one of these buildings. You know, the city here sometimes has tax foreclosures that they're trying to sell, and they often have historic properties, and I've been invited by them to go in and see some of these old, once fabulous mansions, and some of them on the inside, again, have been completely gutted, and you think, you know, there's nothing here, but you do a little research, and there's one place, turned out that the guy who had built the mansion was then charged with embezzling tons of money from his company, and he fled to another state, and people were worried that the banks were going to fail because of this embezzlement, and so the mayor got a bunch of money and paraded down Wisconsin Avenue with this cash to prove that they had plenty of money.
Wow.
So really, there's almost, you know, the other day I went to a building that the city was going to sell, that the city is selling, and didn't really know what to expect. It turned out it was an old Turner Hall, and in the 50s it had a jazz club in it, and Billie Holiday played there for 4 nights. So I feel like, you know, everywhere I go, I find it's almost impossible not to find something interesting.
Right, and you write about Shank Hall, the legendary Milwaukee music venue. That's one that had layers upon layers of interesting stuff going on. Can you tell us some of that history?
Yeah, the interesting thing to me about that is that I'm a musician. I've been in bands, and, you know, since 1984, I've played a number of times at Shank Hall. I've been to see shows there. But I had no idea of its history beyond its history, you know, as a a nightclub, which was only, you know, from the early 70s on. It turns out early on, I mean, there's two buildings. The back building was an old sort of Victorian coach house, which is really cool. But then built on the front is just kind of a low single-story building that for a long time was just a garage, didn't really have much going on. But in the late 40s, it turns out Capitol Records buys the building and turns it into their Wisconsin distribution headquarters, which means in the all through the 50s, when, you know, they were putting out Les Paul records and Nat King Cole records, and into the 60s when the, you know, the Beatles came to Milwaukee in 64, all of those records were being distributed throughout Wisconsin from that location, which I thought was a really cool connection for a rock and roll nightclub.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the life that might have lived in that building. You might have had famous people dropping by to see where these records are being made.
Yeah, incredible. And, you know, even though a lot of this stuff really is hidden because even the owner of the club, the guy who's owned it for 30-plus years, had no idea about this. Hmm. So it's really interesting how much history is around us that we just don't even realize.
Could you see any remnants of that Capitol Records distribution, or is that just gone? You just found that by following the paper trail?
Yeah, I found that by the paper trail. There's nothing really left there. There is some interesting stuff in the old Victorian part. Is actually quite beautiful. There's some rooms upstairs that have just this beautiful ceiling. And down in the basement, you could see where the doors were that opened up to let the horses in and out, and there's rings in the, you know, embedded into the wall where they used to tie up horses.
And the venue itself has a long musical history. Who are some of the famous artists who stopped by and performed there?
Oh yeah, when it was Teddy's first, it was they had a lot of blues and folk and stuff, and they had legends like Muddy Waters played there numerous times, and Shank Hall has had just everyone, you know, from like Warren Zevon. They've had Garbage, Wilco, the Flaming Lips, Alanis Morissette, Blue Oyster Cult. I mean, just everybody across all kinds of genres.
And when you're doing your urban spelunking, you keep referencing something called Sanford Map, I think it is. What is that?
Oh, the Sanborn Maps. Sanborn was a company that made these fire insurance maps, which were especially a big deal back then when everything was made out of wood. so they, you know, they had every year they would do these really, really detailed maps of the city, and every building that existed was listed, and they told you all sorts of things, like whether it was heated by furnaces or stoves, and told you sometimes square footage and all kinds of, did they have gas lighting or electric lighting. So you can get a lot of information off these maps, and they're especially good because if you compare, like, you know, the public library here has 1894 edition and 1910 edition editions of the maps online that you can search. It makes it really easier to figure out where additions had been put on and where how buildings changed over the years.
We're talking with Bobby Tanzillo right now, writer and senior editor for On Milwaukee, talking about his regular feature called Urban Spelunking, where he goes and digs into the history of historic buildings in Milwaukee. And you write about also another, it's kind of more of a complex of buildings, it seems like. I think it's called La Lune. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. La Lune is a really fascinating story because, again, it's another one of these things that you sort of look at it and you think, well, it's got a pretty, you know, the main part of the building is cream city brick and it's got a nice arch over the door. But beyond that, you don't really know what the story is. But it turns out it was built by H. Schmidt and Son, which was a contractor that actually built, they built their own building, which was that one. But they also built a lot of well-known buildings in the city, including the Wisconsin Gas building that has the flame on top, and some prominent churches and things like that. And nowadays, it's home to a furniture company that actually has their factory in a building out back, and they also rent space to the Florentine Opera Company. So it's from the outside, it looks like kind of a quiet little building, but inside, it's a hive of activity.
Wow. So do you ever feel like these buildings, you know, that they really are, they're secret keepers, that there's the little treasure troves of the past?
Yeah, I feel like they really are, and I think it's important that On Milwaukee allows me to kind of go out and sort of unlock the secrets. You know, I don't want to overstate what I do, but I mean, it's all out there, and I'm just kind of going and getting it.
Does it ever feel sad to you that some of these, you know, I'm thinking about Shang Hall, for instance, that Capitol Records history, it's just kind of wiped clean when you look at the building itself. Do these buildings strike you as sad, or is this kind of powerful?
It depends. If I look at a building like Laloon or Shank, I mean, to me it's powerful that, you know, in both those cases, it's interesting that you named those two, because really both of them have a present that's tied to their past, even though they did, you know, in the Shank case, they didn't realize it. You know, it has this sort of musical history, but it's living a vibrant life now as a musical building. So it makes me happy that it's continuing that tradition, even if it's unknowing. But Laloon, the owner of Laloon, told me that what he really appreciated was when he found the history of the company that had built the buildings and had been there up until he had been there, was that, like his company, Schmidt & Sons was an immigrant company. They were a German company. They hired other Germans. They spoke German in the building, you know, when they were there together. And Laloon has, you know, works hard to hire, you know, new Americans too. And so he really feels like it's carrying on this tradition. And so those buildings don't make me sad. The ones that make me sad tend to be the ones that are closed or falling down or just in really bad shape, and they look like they have no future. Those are the ones that make me sad.
So you've been at this for a little while. Are there still Holy Grail buildings that you want to explore that are on your list?
Oh, yeah, there's always more. And, you know, I drive a pretty good distance every day to and from work and school and doing my circuit. And so I see buildings all the time that I think I just get interested in. But some of the big ones are the North Point Water Tower. I know it's just a staircase in there up to the top, but I feel like that would be great to be able to go up there. And I'm also really interested in the water treatment plant along the lake, just to kind of, it's a beautiful building, but also to get inside and kind of see how that all works and explain to people how that works, because I don't think that people really understand how that key element of their daily life is transformed and brought to them. Then sort of smaller neighborhood ones, there's a school, a closed Lutheran school called St. Stephen's School on the south side that I've always been dying to get into, and I just have never had any luck.
Well, I hope you get your chance. Bobby, it's been fun talking today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Bobby Tanzillo is a writer and senior editor for On Milwaukee, talking about his feature called Urban Spelunking, and there is a link to that on the Central Time Facebook page.
It's Food Friday. Today, Lori Skelton is back with us in the studio to share her tips for simple fish preparation.
And what about you? Do you have any questions about cooking with fish? What's your favorite way to prepare seafood? Are you intimidated by the process of cooking fish? And what do you struggle with in particular? You can share your questions and your advice at 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lori Skelton is with us now. She's one of WPR's in-house foodies, a regular here on Food Friday. Lori, welcome back.
Good to be here. Hello.
Well, what led you to want to tackle fish on Food Friday? I think it might have been partly from talking with us about cooking with fish.
Exactly, because I get to go to our family place in Florida over the Christmas holiday, and there you can find fresh fish in varieties we just don't have in Wisconsin. And I was telling Veronica about the different kinds of snapper that I had tried for the first time a few months ago. And I was saying that the best way to try a fish you've never tried before, simply pan fry it and serve it over salad greens. And that's when you said, you should tell us how to do fish in a simple way. So that's what got it started.
Right, because I eat fish when I go out, but I mm-hmm. never cook it at home because I don't know what I'm doing with fish. I feel like I'm a pretty good cook, but fish, I don't know. It just seems like it's got some extra challenges, even though it cooks up in a snap. I know it's fast, but it seems tricky to do it well. Is it tricky, Lori?
Oddly enough, it's the speed that can sometimes be tricky for a lot of people. Say it's a weeknight, we've got two kids going to different activities after school, and you don't know when your spouse is coming home. If you've got something like fish that can cook up in 10 minutes and can overcook very easily, that is a little intimidating because you don't know when you're actually going to be serving dinner. Mm. So speed can sometimes be a problem with fish. The other problem these days, of course, is it healthy for me, and is it sustainable? Fortunately, you've got a great way to check that out beforehand. The Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch website, which is seafoodwatch.org. They have an app, of course they do, but they also have printable guides for each state, and they update those guides at least 4 times a year. So before you go out looking for fish, you can print out one of these guides and take it with you.
Now, you said a great basic way to try a new kind of fish is to pan fry it. So let's talk through, I understand there's a couple categories. There's like lean white fish and the oilier fish. So if you've got, what are the lean white fish, and then how do we do that basic, you know, pan fry it, serve it on some salad or relish or whatever?
Lean white fish, certainly the color is a giveaway, and also it's not going to have an oily texture. When in doubt, ask, but you can always start with tilapia or cod or bass, grouper, haddock, catfish, lake perch, of course, whitefish, walleye, snapper. You know, if you're not going out to your fishmonger, if somebody is coming over, say, hey, look what we just caught at the lake. Pan frying those thinner fillets would be a great way to go.
So when you say pan fry, that sounds really obvious. You have a pan and you fry something in it. But can you walk us through it? Because I always thought you were supposed to kind of sear the fish.
You do want a hot pan, which is why if you're searing fish, a nonstick pan is wonderful. But if you don't have a nonstick pan that's big enough for your fish fillets, go ahead, add a little more oil, and make certain your pan is hot. You want your fish to start off pretty dry. And one easy way to do this is don't try seasoning both sides of the fish at once. Give just one side of it salt and pepper. Warm your olive oil or butter in your skillet, hot pan. Then you put the fish down, season side down. Now, this is the really important part. Don't move it. You have to let it sit on your pan for 2 minutes to develop that lovely, nice sear before you flip it. And then once you flip it, you can season the other side. Again, once you flipped it, don't move it.
So wait, can you move it?
Because I really want to move the fish at this
Me
juncture.
Me too. I love moving fish.
You want it to sit undisturbed in that pan so it gets nice and hot and cooked through. It develops a lovely, crispy, crunchy exterior. And of course, if you want it even crispier and crunchier, go ahead and dredge it in flour or breadcrumbs before you put it in the pan. A little cornmeal is always nice.
Yeah, and with that cornmeal, do I have to egg dip it first, or do I just do it in the dry stuff?
You do it in the dry stuff. You really don't have to egg dip it. Egg is certainly lovely. It will certainly add a little bit more flavor to it. But if we're talking basic, if we're talking, I want to find out what does this particular kind of fish taste like, the less you do with it, the better.
Talking with Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies right now for Food Friday. And we're talking about advice for cooking with fish. And Lori, when you're not doing your simple pan fry, another way you can go, you might think about using parchment paper or some tinfoil packets. I understand that's another pretty simple way to go. Can't go too wrong with that. How do we do those?
You can find, again, online, if you want to find out exactly how the French fold up those beautiful parchment paper packets, go right ahead and get fancy. Or you can just take a nice big piece of foil, put a tiny little bit of oil in it, put your fish on top of that, put vegetables on top of that fish, and then some sort of liquid so it's going to steam in that packet. A little bit of broth, water is fine, but if you wanted to throw some citrus juice or white wine in there, maybe a little vinegar, that's great. Then you just wrap up the packet. You don't want it super tight. You want to have room for steam to develop in there, but you also don't want anything to leak out. So wrap up your packet, put it in a fairly hot oven. Packets are a great idea for those weeknights when you don't know who's coming or going for dinner. Now, I know last week you were talking about vegetable prep and prepping ahead of time, cooking ahead of time. Boy, if you can put your packets together in the morning, say you've got 4 people to worry about for dinner, you make 4 individual packets of fish and vegetables. Everybody can choose maybe what they want. So if somebody doesn't want broccoli, you don't put it in their packet. Then you've got those packets waiting, and you put them in the oven as people are ready to have their dinner. Real easy way to go.
I want to get to the recipe we have on the Central Time Facebook page now. I missed this one, unfortunately. I was gone when you brought it in. That's okay. That's okay. It's not all about me.
It was pretty tasty.
It was really good, I hear. It was a fish pie. And again, you can find this recipe on the Central Time Facebook page. This, I looked at the recipe. It looked awesome, Lori.
I wasn't planning on including a fish pie. Fish pie under mashed potatoes is classic British comfort food, but it's not necessarily simple. Classic British preparations is you poach the fish in milk, and then you use that milk plus a roux to make a white sauce. It gets really, really, really involved. I happened across Jamie Oliver, the British chef. He didn't have a recipe online. He was using a simple fish pie to demonstrate his line of utensils. But I looked at this recipe and thought, you could have this on the table in an hour. And I also thought, okay, not all of us have access to great fresh fish all the time. Why don't I try making a fish pie with frozen fish? And I made a fish pie with frozen salmon, frozen cod, and about 6 ounces of frozen shrimp. I used minimal seasoning. I brought it in expecting Wisconsin Public Radio people to be polite about it. And that pie was devoured. I brought in a fairly sizable pie, and it was gone, and everybody wanted the recipe. So I sat down with the video. I think I've come up with actual recipe, you know, how much butter, how much fish. In line with Jamie Oliver's video, I tried it again over the weekend using fresh fish this time. I added a little more seasoning. And again, no leftovers.
Oh, it was so good. I have to say, I went in there skeptical. Someone said, hey, Lori's fish pies in the break room. I was like, all right, I'll do it a try for Food Friday. I don't know, because I think I'm more of a purist. I want it to be a piece of fish. But that was delicious and also really comforting. And it didn't taste overly fishy, even though it had all these varieties of fish in there. It was really comforting.
And again, trying it out with frozen fish that had been thawed, not always the greatest taste. And I think having the option, and we've got several suggestions on how to personalize this, having the option of adding more seasoning or adding horseradish to the mashed potatoes, giving it a chance to make it your own and make it a little more robust, can get you past the, well, it's maybe not the greatest cut of fish I've ever had, but it's still a good pie.
And it seems like this is a recipe with some wiggle room. Sometimes when I think fish, like, you got to be really precise and get it just right. This you can play with, and a minute here, a minute there, no problem.
Absolutely. And people got so creative with their suggestions as to how they would season it. Some would use different herbs. Somebody actually sat down and said, I'll bet you could do this Creole style.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
And
the shrimp, yeah, sure.
And they were actually talking about, I wouldn't mind even having some leftover blackened fish thrown in here as well. So we've got suggestions on the Central Time Facebook page, but you can really have fun with this and get creative.
We're talking to Food Friday regular Lori Skelton right now about simple ways to prepare fish on this Food Friday.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite way to cook with fish? What do you struggle with when it comes to cooking with seafood? Are you a fish cooking pro, or do you fear the fish? Maybe Lori can help you overcome your doubts, your worries, your concerns. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post and find that fish pie recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation and get to your calls in just a little bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion now with Food Friday regular Lori Skelton talking about simple ways to cook with fish.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you need some advice on cooking with fish in general, a particular kind of fish? Do you have fears and reservations that Lori can help you overcome? Or are you a pro at cooking with fish? You can offer some advice yourself. Share your favorite recipes and your questions now at 800-642-1234 or post and find a fish pie recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our first caller now. We've got Jim joining us in Colfax. Jim, hi.
Oh, long-time fan of your show. This is great.
Oh, thanks.
And talking about fish is right up my alley. Well, throughout the winter, it's nice to go ice fishing. You come home with your 25 nice fresh fish, flay them off the bone. You know, it's pretty simple to do for the most people if you follow the instructions. Take your fresh fish, and then from there, you can just throw it in a little shore lunch. You can throw it in the flour. You can season your flour with some salt and pepper, maybe a little Lowry's, different things, depending on your taste buds. Chili powder, all kinds of different things you can put in there. From there, just throw it in either your deep fryer or right into a pan of oil. I use a wok. For the most part, it works really well because it spreads the fish out nicely across the top, and that way they all get nice golden brown. So, and you can do that with just about any kind of white fish. And when you put it on your paper towels, it takes the oil out of it, so it's not like you're getting a big oily mess or anything.
Right.
So, and when they're golden brown, they're done. Now, a couple nights ago, I made salmon, and I make it quite often. And I love using the tin foil packets because you can portion it up. You can put whatever seasonings on there if one person likes a little spicier things. And just like your guest was saying, you can cater it to whatever needs you need on that. Not only that, it stays fresh in the packet if you just shut your oven off, and you can leave them right in the oven nice and, you know, it stays nice and warm for a long period of time. With that, though, I have a little secret that I take the salmon, and if I use the tin foil packets, take the skin off, and you don't have to deal with it after the fact, but pour maple syrup over the top of it. So season it first with your salt and pepper, or, you know, little parsley flakes work great. And from there, just dribble some maple syrup over it. And when it cooks, it just gives it a nice, a little bit, takes the fishy flavor away for people that don't like that fish flavor. The oil from the salmon drains out of the bottom, you know, stays towards the bottom of the packet, so you're not getting the oil from the salmon afterwards.
Jim,
right.
Thank you. Wow. You are a fish aficionado. He knows how to cook a fish.
Aficionado, get it?
That's very good.
See what you did there.
Yeah, so the maple syrup thing, Lori, that seems pretty revolutionary there.
Not,
maple syrup on salmon.
Well, I suppose, but if you think about it, have you ever had like a soy glaze? Have you had teriyaki?
Yes.
Okay, so while it's going to be a little bit sweeter, it's going to have that similar effect of, you know, caramelizing and working. With the oily fish, that robust flesh can stand up to added sweetness. And my go-to way to prepare a fat salmon fillet is bake it with a little bit of grainy mustard spread over it and swimming in a pool of cider.
Cider.
And I've discovered that apples and oily fish are great. If you've got a whole mackerel that you want to cook, stuff that thing with apples in the cavity and maybe a little bit of cider in the cavity as well. Apples and mackerel are brilliant together.
Wow.
Jim, thanks for the call. Fish on. We'll go next to Larry in Pell Lake. Larry, hi.
How are you doing today?
Good. What do you got for us, Larry?
All righty. I found this recipe in probably a 1940s. Little cookbook. I tried it and it was absolutely incredible. You take just like a cup of flour and you season it with salt and Italian seasoning, and you just dredge your I used cod fillets, and you just dredge them in there and shake off the excess, and you put it in a prepared baking dish, and then you take butter. And you melt some butter, and you put it, you mix it with cornflake crumbs.
Oh, yeah.
you sprinkle the cornflake crumbs on top of the fish, and then you take a cup or so of cream, or half and half, and you pour it around the outside edge of the fish. You don't want to knock off the cornflake crumbs. And then you bake it. And the cream and the flour makes this wonderful little, it's not a thick gravy, but kind of a watery gravy, but a nice gravy. And the sweetness from the cream and the Italian spices, oh, my God.
Wow.
Larry,
thank you.
But you went to heaven.
That sounds so great. And it sounds like simple in a way, but I bet it comes out looking and tasting really fancy. Lori, he had you at cornflake crumbs.
Well, I've certainly, he said this came from a 1940s cookbook, and I've certainly had that when I was growing up from older cooks in Wisconsin. I will be honest, I don't eat cornflakes, so it's not something I would have in my cupboard. It's not something I'd think about, but that's certainly an option. You know, just like if you've got panko breadcrumbs, it's got that similar crunchy texture. So yeah, cornflakes would be great.
Well, it's Food Friday. Lori Skelton is here with us to talk about how to cook fish, and you can join us at 800-642-1234 with your fish questions and your fish wisdom. And there's a lot of that in Wisconsin so far, we're finding. Let's go next to Bob joining us in Burlington. Bob, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I started out looking for a recipe for rhubarb that didn't require 3 parts of sugar for every part of rhubarb. And so I was experimenting around with a bunch of different recipes and everything else like that. And what I really liked most was a stir-fry recipe for a fish because, you know, you throw your vegetables in there and your fish and the whole 9 yards, and you, in 15 minutes it's done, you know. And so I tried sprinkling some rhubarb in with my vegetables.
Wow.
And it turned out pretty good. It gives a little bit of a tart taste to it, you know, similar if you would add lemon or whatever else you would throw in. And it's very quick and easy and comes out pretty good.
And what kind of fish are you using in the stir fry?
Actually, I'm using just about any kind of fish, you know, anywhere from bluegills to pike, bass, and even in the salmon and trout, you know.
Okay.
Most of the stuff I've been catching out of the lake.
Again,
you know?
With the oilier fish like the salmon, I could definitely see where rhubarb would work. I hadn't thought of something lighter, but that will be something to try later when my rhubarb comes up in 2 weeks.
The fish would flake, right? If you're tossing everything in a stir fry, you'd get little flakes of fish?
You might get a little flake of fish, depending on how vigorously you're going to be stirring. Of course, the fish will be the last thing that goes mm-hmm. in after the vegetables. So I don't think you'd need to worry about your fish disintegrating that much. But then again, you want to be working with a fairly thick cut of fish to begin with if you're going to be doing that.
Thanks for the call, Bob. We'll go next to Dan on the line in Madison. Dan, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm looking for any advice or tips or tricks on smoking salmon.
Ooh. Are you a salmon smoker, Lori? Have you done this?
Well, it's been done, but I've never had the chance to smoke it on the stove. Is that what you're talking about?
In a smoker. I have a charcoal smoker I'll be whipping out this weekend.
Mm-hmm. And there aren't any suggestions with your smoker as to what to do? Because I know smokers can be, each one can be different as to how long you want to have that in there. With salmon, I think you'd want to be going for apple wood, correct?
That sounds good.
Okay. I don't know as I'd go for anything stronger than that with salmon, but I will be honest, every smoker I've ever dealt with or I've watched somebody else deal with is different. So I'd be a little bit hesitant to give you step-by-step instructions on the air. Start with apple wood. You're not going to need to have it in there for probably more than 2 hours, but check with your own instructions and see what happens.
I've seen cedar planked salmon quite a bit, mm-hmm. and I know that it has like a nice flavor that goes well with the salmon, so maybe that's another option. Well, that's great. A fish smoker. I love smoked salmon, so yeah. Good luck with you with that, Dan.
Yeah. If your housemates don't mind, there are very easy ways to smoke fish on a big pan on your stovetop, nice and slow. But be warned, your house is going to smell smoky for quite some time afterward.
So, Lori, before we let you go, just a couple seconds left. What is one easy fish to work with if we want to start out and try this?
Well, we're getting into grilling season. Putting a whole fish on the grill is really, really easy. If you can get them, one thing I discovered putting this program together is if you can find whole, fresh sardines, put those on the grill. Rub them down with oil, herbs, stuff a little bit of garlic into the cavity. Hot fire, 2 minutes on a side. The flesh is moist, the skin is crispy, absolutely fantastic with a beer.
Well, sounds great. Lori, thanks so much for coming by today.
Absolutely.
That was Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house foodies and a Food Friday regular, and she joined us to talk about simple, easy ways to make fish. And you can find a link to that super yummy fish pie that Lori made over on the Central Time Facebook page. Stay with us on Central Time.
Is it okay to be crabby at work? We saw a piece on this on the website Quartz. It turns out there's been a lot of recent research about mood and behavior in the workplace.
And the conventional wisdom is we should be happy and friendly, or at least do a decent job faking being happy and friendly. But some of the research finds that forcing ourselves to have a positive attitude can actually make us less productive and hurt employee morale. So, Rob, I think you were thinking this was pretty good news for you, at least today. You were feeling a little cranky.
Wait a minute. Well, I didn't sleep a little out of it today. I hope I wasn't too cranky.
No, you weren't too cranky.
But this idea, I mean, I generally try to, even if I'm not feeling like in a great mood, I try to be friendly and polite to people. I think that's okay. But the research seems to say, you know what? Don't force it. Don't go with that fake it till you make it sort of put on a smile, even if you're feeling in a really bad mood.
Well, I mean, people can, you know, sense a fake smile and fake friendliness. Mm-hmm. And it's probably, I don't know, maybe it is better to just be our true selves. And if that means letting the crabby flag fly, so be it.
And on the other side of things, the research seems to say, all right, if your coworker's crabby today, well, let it go. Cut them some slack. And I think that's good. Tough for people in retail, though. I mean, we've mm-hmm. both worked in service type jobs in the past. You really do have to fake it in those jobs.
Right, but I can always tell. I always feel bad when I walk away and I've been the victim of a professional smile.
Well, I'm professionally
smiling. We could go all day back and forth.
Professionally smiling at you now. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Thanks.